Hello, and welcome to CRO Insights, How CROs Win, the podcast that uncovers the key markers of successful revenue leadership, brought to you by the CRO Collective in partnership with the Revenue Operations Alliance. In each episode, we'll explore the CRO career path, the major challenges facing CROs today, and discover strategies for building aligned revenue engines that scale your company's growth. Because the first thing I would like to do, if you don't mind, as a way of introduction, is if you just provide a little background on you, your company, what you do, and your journey as it pertains not just to the services that you provide, but also from your sort of ascension into being a founder of a company and all the things that went along with that. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, love that. And super pleased to be here as well. Thank you, Warren.
It's
a pleasure to talk. I'm loving the opportunity to talk about OKRs. But my name is Nick Buxton. I'm the fractional chief revenue officer at a few businesses, Ocular Technologies being the one I'm working with at the moment. I'm a 2 times chief revenue officer, 5 times head of sales. And I did the normal journey, started off in sales, individual contributor, worked my way up through sales director, head of sales, VP sales, VP EMEA, all the way up to chief revenue officer. Had a really good journey, really enjoyed it, loved it, worked some brilliant businesses all the way through from C to Series A, B, C and FTSE listed businesses. Learned a load along the way. And it just always struck me how hard it was to align all the different facets of a business to make sure that you deliver a revenue outcome. It's just something that is so hard and is struggled with by so many businesses, no matter the size of business. You know, you look at businesses like Zoom, you look at Figma, you look at all of these really wonderful businesses that just essentially look like they've come from nowhere, and you think, God, they've really nailed it. They've absolutely smashed it. But there's no secret sauce. There's no secret sauce to really good alignment, understanding your sales and marketing objectives and the levers you need to pull, and making sure that you nail that growth at each stage, like being really, really focused and committed to growth trajectory at each stage in every part of the business.
I concur with you. I would like to provide a little, in my mind, a little spin on that point. I think you're right. I mean, obviously, it's why I started my business for the same reason. I guess a couple questions come from that, which I'll ask in succession, and if you don't mind, end with a perspective. Yeah. But one is, one thing we can explore is why it is you think that it's so hard and why it is that we can't figure it out. And then the second one is, if you think that it really is, if there really is no codified solution, or if it's really just that we've been doing it wrong and we're not willing to listen to stuff. And here's why I asked that question. Because I think if you look at just, I'm thinking a little more scientifically now, almost even like an engineer. So, you know, how many startups there have been, or how many businesses there have been since the business has ever been created? I mean, it's millions of businesses, yeah. Right? So we certainly have enough data of business models to look at to know what worked and what didn't work. And I know there's a lot of talk in a lot of business sectors that there's some sort of magic, right? Like, two businesses can be created the same exact way, but one works and the other doesn't, and there's some sort of ethereal magic that we can attribute. I think that's probably true to some degree. I think there is something that we can't certain always know. It's the same reason why, you know, you date 10 women and for some reason one of them works out. It's sort of hard to know why that is. And if we figure that out, we probably all get married to the right people. We never have divorces. But I think there's something to it, though, and I would say there's something else. And I would say similarly in the way that I just kind of analogized relationships. I think the same thing applies to businesses in that I think regardless of how much data we get and how much information we get, I think we still, we do the same things over and over again anyway, despite knowing that they didn't work before. And number two is that whether we like it or not, I think businesses are really essentially emotional enterprises. They're not business enterprises. And we think they're business enterprises, but they're not. And I say that because I don't think a business can start as a business enterprise. I think it can become a business enterprise. But any business that starts is an emotional enterprise and therefore open to a lot of interpretation that may be fly in the face of logic and form. and I do think, I've been thinking about this a lot, as you probably can imagine from what I'm doing all the time, is I do think, in fact, there probably is some set of codified ways we can build businesses better. I just don't think that we do them. So I'm just sort of like curious to know what your thoughts are on that idea, if you think it makes sense or if I'm completely full of it or not.
No, I think you're absolutely spot on both points. Let me take the second point first. I think there's lots of codified ways of growing. And I think part of society's problems is that we think just because someone else has done it, it's going to work for me.
Yep.
Like, if I train like Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'm not going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yep. I might eat like him, I might do everything right, but I'll have a different outcome because my genetics are different, my hormones are different, like I'll execute it slightly different, ever so slightly differently to he would have, and maybe it's something he didn't write about that made yep. a big difference, that would make a difference to the way I outcomed. So I think there's something about knowing firsthand what strategies are about, understanding the different codified ways that people can grow businesses, but not using that as a copy and paste. We can't just use the sales acceleration formula and do everything Mark Robo says and be like, nailed it, like this is another tech business. Otherwise, all of the VC businesses, all of Mark Robo's, I think it's C2 Capital, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That are invested in by him would just be a success. That's just not the way it works.
Yep.
We need to go back to first basic principles of what is the business, what is the product, and how do customers find value in that, before we can leverage how we take it to market, how we scale it, and how we make sure that everyone's getting value that you can build a sustainable business on. The other bit on why we aren't getting it right with so many businesses, in the microcosm of SaaS, it's a particularly high attrition rate.
Yep.
Like really, really low success rate, especially if you look into past Series B, we're talking like 0.5% of businesses that make it that far. And in those scenarios, businesses have got a real tension between what's good for the business and what's good for the board, what is different than what's good for investors and the rest of the people who've got money in the business. I think there's a challenge around that of people want to go out and raise money and they want to grow businesses, but they will do it probably a bit prematurely than they think they are. So they will go out, raise some money, establishing they've got product market fit. And at that point, the investor will give them some money and then they'll be like, right, okay, we've got product market fit. Now time to hit the jets. We now need to see growth. And going too early in that process means you're going to get a load of churn, means your product is going to be behind in chasing some of those things that aren't ideal customer because you're just signing people because you need revenue growth.
Yep.
And then you get into like this churn cyclone of chasing more revenue to backfill. And at some point, it becomes really, really difficult to understand what the business is and where the value is coming from. So I think that in the microcosm of SaaS is a real challenge.
Well, no doubt. And you're right in that the other layer that you just articulated and we tend to not really give enough credence to is how this SaaS business bubble informed the way businesses should be operated. And it's not, like you said, everyone can't be Schwarzenegger. And I think that we've had enough unicorns in the SaaS business that everyone thinks that they can be Salesforce or whatever, and it's not true. And I think the financial community has been, you know, sort of, I would say, complicit in, you know, money fuels, right? Money is the fuel for all these things. Or this is how things happen, is you need funding. And so
100%.
So, you know, if I'm, you mentioned a couple of things in your response, which I think are really great. One is like, the things like churn and all those other things are, in my view, are all associated with physics, quantum physics, which is like, why is it that we apply pressure to a system? Why is pressure being applied to a system that's creating these constraints? And, you know, there's a balance between we apply pressure to a system so that the system can function a certain way, but those constraints sometimes are not relevant to the outcome. They're more third party things. Like, I think financial constraints are the big one. So if someone gives me money and that money needs to be paid back in a certain period of time, that is a separate outside constraint that has nothing to do with the customer. Right. And so those two things have a hard time living in the same system, and they do, and we have to manage those things. I do think speed to market, speed to result, speed to return is a major constraint on businesses. And I think it has a big impact on how we start to compromise principles when it comes to customer delivery and product integrity. And I think that these are things that if we don't work them out, we're always going to have this problem. We're never going to get out of it. And I do think that these are the sort of idiocy sort of things. I don't mean to be consulting about it, but I mean, it's more like how we've created a system that is almost designed to be broken because of the way that we manage things.
Agreed. And I feel more optimistic about the investing that's happening now than I have been for the past 3 years. Like the zero interest rate period, there was some terrible investment decisions made for some businesses that didn't last surprisingly that long. Yep. And I hope as a investment community and a SaaS software go-to-market universe, we've learned a bit of a lesson in that, is that we need to focus on unit economics. Net revenue retention and gross revenue retention are the best indicators of whether you've got product market fit and whether you've got a healthy business. And we need to look at unit economics. Like, you can't blow your brains out and just hope to chase and raise a massive amount again down the road, because hopefully people are wise to that. Like, you just need to build a business that is eventually saleable at the end. Like, we need to go back to business basics of, you need to sell each thing that you're selling for slightly more than all the cost and everything that you've loaded to deliver that service.
Yep.
And that's an investable business.
Yeah. And the other element of that, as I'm sure you know, is that within that model and that ratio of cost to profit has to equally be a measurable value that's received by the person that's purchased the product, that they want it again and again and again. And, you know, if you can work out those two things, obviously you have sort of like that, what we call that magical thing. But here's what I would say is, I don't think that what we just said is magic. I think it's just formulaic. I think if we just make a formula that works sense of way. And, you know, not all businesses are going to work, right? We can probably make some of those computations pretty early on and say, you know, this is something that people want and this is something I can produce, but it costs me too much to make given what people are willing to pay for it. So it's just not a good business right now. Maybe we can wait until the unit economics can become, or we can bring them down in some way. But if it compromises the value of the delivery, then you don't have a business anymore. So I do think that many times there's sort of like this hope and pray thing where it's like, man, people really want this thing. Let's just put it out there. I know there's demand. It'll work itself out. And it sort of doesn't work itself out. But if I've got enough people invested in it, likely the emotional pull will be that they're going to continue to invest more to hope that they can get themselves out of a bad situation instead of pull the plug on it. Now, you're right. I think that now that money costs more, people are being more, they're being more sober about the way they make those decisions. And in a strange way, it was nice to know that there was a period of time where money flowed and people could get funding. But that exuberance comes with a lot of compromises, because people, and if I can give money to anybody, well, then, you know, it's sort of like, makes for a lot of bad decisions. I think there should be constraints on these things. I think interest rates, while they kind of suck, they also create like a bit of a stop, you know, filter on how people are a bit more reluctant to think about things. They're forced to have to be smarter about the way they make investments, which I don't think is a bad thing. So anyway, I this is a really important topic. It's one I talk about a lot. And, you know, there's a combination between the dynamics we're talking about, which are kind of, a lot of them are like physics and things like that. And then there's like business models, which you just talked about, which are things like managing people and finding the right product and constructing the right model. So I want to talk about that a bit. So if you don't mind, like, you mentioned OKRs and things, and what are some ways in which the way that you go to market in your business and what you do, you've worked out some of these things? Because I know your business is very much predicated on the idea of kind of helping people figure this stuff out. So I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on philosophically, where you think the right answers are, if you've, how close you've gotten to that right now, the way you go to do your business.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things that's ever evolving and getting closer. No one's ever nailed it, and I'm no different. But what I do know is through experience, I know some of the things that won't work, and I know some of the strategies that will. One of the headlines I thought that would be interesting and maybe a bit salacious for us to talk a bit about was OKRs. And OKRs are like one of those things that are the modern day fresh thinking business panacea to growth alignment across most businesses. And I think they're a great concept. So, you know, originated by Andy Grove, the CEO in the 70s of Intel. Mm-hmm. He took it, or one of his employees took it to Google in the 90s. John Deere, I think it was, or John Doe. John Doe took it to the Google team in the 90s. Did a really good job, and that was where I think we all grew up knowing.
Okay. So for the uninitiated, what, how do you define OKRs?
OKRs are objectives and key results. It's a broad framework that a lot of businesses will use to align different business units under a normal strategy. So the objective is that we need to raise or deliver X amount of revenue. Within each team, what are our key results that are going to ladder up to us doing that? And I love it in theory. It's a great principle because we need a golden thread that runs between the different businesses and aligning them so that boards, investors, the rest of the teams have got confidence that we're going to achieve these things. I think the difficulty is that in reality is what we get is a set of straight bar handcuffs that lashes to each other and hinder progress rather than helping each business leader be fluid within the right hand restraints and right guardrails to be able to achieve their objectives. So I've worked in three businesses directly where we've used OKRs and they are disappointingly never delivered. So I wanted to maybe have a conversation about, I bet there's some really good use cases of it, but if anyone's had any great experiences, I'd love to hear them. But it's it often tends to be more disappointing than not because it's an overinvestment of time rather than a great result return.
Yeah, look, agreed. I think the idea of an OKR and the way you described it obviously makes perfect sense. You're essentially creating nothing more than a certain sense of process agreements that can run across different channels, functions that everyone agrees upon. It gives them, like you call it a good word, a thread that everyone can tie to, and it should create some consistency across things. But my question to you is, and I'm sure you probably have a lot of thoughts on this, what do you think those things are? Like, why is it that when you create them that they don't happen? What are the things in place or the dynamics that affect the ability for an OKR to fulfill itself?
I was so excited in the first business that we used OKRs because I was like, I've heard about this thing, I've read about it, we're going to actually use it and we're going to see the benefits and we're all going to be aligned. It's going to be magic. It's going to be so much more useful to help bring everyone on the journey of what we need to do for revenue. And in that startup, we had a real difficult time rolling them out. And I was like, oh, I don't know why we're finding this so hard. We must have spent hundreds of hours on it. We've created a very convoluted but clear central master Excel where we measured everything. It was started at the team level and then went all the way down to individuals. And that was in the December. And then at the end of December, we had our festive party and we had a speaker come in. And it was a chap called Bruce Daisley. Have you heard of Bruce Daisley?
Warren? No.
He was VP of EMEA for Twitter, like during the heyday. So during real boom growth, really interesting guy. He's one of the top voices on LinkedIn now. If you haven't had him on, he'd be a really interesting guest for you. And we had him in, and one of the operations team was like, oh, Bruce, what's your opinion on OKRs? And I think this was 2019, 2020. And he took pause, and I was like, oh, how's this going to go? And he said, in my experience, they don't do enough good for a business. You end up spending too much time in admin chasing them in the benefits outputted of alignment. And everyone in the room was quite shocked because like we just onboarded it. We spent a load of time on it. But he said, yeah, I wouldn't advise them because I think in terms of the results, they're probably not worth it. And our CEO piped up and said, you know, well, I'm sure we're implementing the right way. So we're just going to carry on doing it. But thanks for your input, Bruce. Lo and behold, we didn't. It was a similar output to Bruce's prediction. But if I think about the areas of why they don't work is they're very time consuming. So they're a quarterly cadence. They take too long to write, which means you're into the quarter when you should be focused on delivering that quarter's effort. They're very output based, which is great, but it just means you don't have that really clear lens of input. And if you think about any really good sales coaching, I'll use sales coaching as an analogy. Kevin Dorsey talks a bit about it, who's a great LinkedIn voice.
Kevin was on my show. Yeah.
Great guy. No good sales leaders talk about the number that much. Like no one's spending a load of coaching time or conversation time or valuable meeting time talking about the number. They're talking about the inputs, their actions, their attitudes, their abilities, the things they're training on, the things they should be doing better to get to the number.
Yep.
So there's like this weird over-reliance on the output, which means you don't really get to the core of why that output is being delivered. So I think that's one of them. The other ones are, it gives you like this false sense of alignment and confidence. Having written the OKRs, it's a sense of real achievement. We've all aligned and, you know, we're all now ready to just get on and do our jobs. So that confidence could be around, if I wrote some OKRs for revenue, it could be, look, this is our ARR. These are the number of meetings we have. This is the pipeline number we need to generate. It's very binary in, like, if I've hit that SQL number or that ARR number, great. But it doesn't consider, like, the health of that pipeline. Like, how many of those leads within a pipeline are ideal customer profile? How many look like someone who's going to be really successful on the platform or have a really high retention rate or really high usage rate? Those metrics aren't viewed in those types of output. So we end up just driving full steam ahead to hit those vanity metrics where we're not thinking more holistically about what we should be doing to drive a durable, scalable, healthy business in each of those areas.
Okay. I get it. I mean, it all makes sense. I'm going to reiterate what I heard back. A couple of things. One is OKRs are time consuming to create, which means the amount of work that goes into them kind of pushes you too deep into the business before you actually get a chance to implement them. So they're like a bit of a, if I would say, maybe a time consuming indulgence to some degree that take up a lot of bandwidth. And then the other thing you mentioned is that they can't be implemented as well as they want because they tend to be false signals and they don't account for other things that the OKRs don't sort of accommodate. And it becomes sort of chasing things that are ancillary to what really matters. So, yeah, I mean, am I right?
No, 100%. And I think what you end up having is a framework that is a band-aid for poor management and poor recruitment. Like, it's then, well, where are your metrics, Nick? Like, this is what you said. I'm going to micromanage you on these elements. And even if you deliver them, it doesn't mean the health of the business is going to be any better. But it means I've got a level of control over you and what you do, rather than an approach that I think we should all be driving for is you hire really senior, really experienced people that are good at their job. We align holistically about what we need to deliver. And we have to give them people the space to do the best thing in their roles as possible. And that isn't based on one metric. Like, if I hit, we've all seen it, like if I hit a massive number in 1 month, it doesn't mean I'm really good at my job. That could be a terrible number of clients that are onboarded and they're going to churn out. We can't view the world in such narrow lenses. We're going to create terrible businesses.
Yeah, look, everything you're saying makes sense. It sounds like, just in short, it's like not OKRs, while they make sense and maybe even could work the way that they're being utilized, it isn't focusing on non-measurable things that matter more to a business than measurable things do. And I know this is like the kind of the human element of things. This is what I tend to focus on mainly when I work with my clients, and this is the issue I run into. And it's fascinating, this conversation, because everybody wants measurable things. Like the deliverables that people want mostly when they work with me, and this when they start working with me, and I understand this, I'm not saying that they're wrong, is they want things like, you know, they want frameworks and playbooks and processes and, you know, things like that. Because at the end of the day, people need to get to work and they need to do things and they need frameworks from which to operate. And I think that makes sense because I think we all do. We need a dashboard of sorts. Yeah. But I think those tactical requirements, they don't take into account other things like, do you have the competencies for this? And do the competencies that you have, are they aligned with the things that you've been asked to do? I ask this question a lot with the people that I
work with.
What I ask them is this question, sort of a bit of a weird way of asking it, but it's provocative. And I basically say, it's like, if there was a room of 100 people you're sitting in a room of 100 people. Let's say like they're all your sort of like your peers, you know. And there was a contest. Someone walked in, some executive walked in and announced the contest. And the winner of this contest is going to get $1 billion and a guarantee that their family is going to be healthy for the remainder of their lives. That's the prize. Okay. Two coveted things everybody wants, right? They want enough money to live and they want to know their family's going to be healthy. And you'll win that. And here's the contest. The contest is it's sort of a quiz in a way, really. Answer this question. If I were to pose a problem, a specific problem to everybody in this room, what would the problem that you'd want to be asked that you know you'd be the one that could do it better than anybody in the room?
Do you want me to answer?
Yeah, I'm just curious to know what your answer would be. That is, just what's your answer to that question? The thing that you know that if all of you were asked one problem to solve, that you'd be the one that, you know, you can get up and you'd be the one that'd be better to do it than anybody in the room.
I would probably say how to translate a product into a go-to-market strategy.
Okay, great. Fine. So you know what it is for yourself. It's pretty quickly able to ascertain that. So then the second question is if the person I'm talking to able to go, I know what it is, it's this. The bigger booby question is that what you're being asked to do in your job right now?
I like it.
Because if you're not doing the thing you're designed to do. So everything is going to be a bit of a struggle for you or a compromise because A, you're not being utilized properly, and B, you're off purpose because you're not doing the thing that you know you should be doing all the time. So the goal is to sort of find a way in which you either seek out roles or things in life that activate that thing that you know you're better than that than anybody. And two is to make sure that when you're being managed, that people know that about you, so they manage you against that. So that way they get the best out of you. And I just think that is not happening anywhere almost. Like people are being asked to do a whole bunch of things either ancillarily to the thing they're great at, or sometimes they're not even doing the thing they're great at. They're completely not at all, you know? And so I think that's one thing. Let's say we can align that. Let's say we can create an organization where we have a way that we can measure
everyone's competent,
right? Yeah. And then we have everybody doing the thing they're supposed to do. Okay, one thing is you probably can see right away how a lot of things would be going a lot better right away, right? That's one thing. Then the second part is the framework within those things are being done. So now we've got all these people doing these things. Now an OKR could be laid on top of that, right? Where now everyone's doing the thing they're best at and they're all clear on what their goals are. I do think that would probably solve most of the problems that I see with, we would call them OKRs or we can call them playbooks or whatever we call, because a lot of people are either not in the right job, or the organization has been structured in such a way that my job, the way that I'm being measured and managed, forces me to have to provide proof of success in ways that have nothing to do with the rest of the bigger outcome of the company.
Yeah.
I think it's the way we set up companies it's a really poor model that we've done. I'm curious what your thoughts are on all that.
Now, do you know what someone said to me the other day, and it struck me, was, I only need to give you a plan if you don't trust me. And I was like, wow, okay, cool. Like, you haven't got the confidence in me of doing whatever it is. Like, I don't need a plan for someone to write an email to a prospect, because they know how to do it.
Yep.
I only need a plan if I'm unsure, which I think is brilliant. But in the other sense, the three main things that people need to be successful are mindset, skill set, and structure. And I think it's in that order. They need the right mindset, and they will acquire the right skills, and then they need a structure to deploy them in that sense.
Yep.
I view OKRs and the like in the same sense, is that if you've got the right mindset and mindset skill set, they can operate under whatever structure they deem, or they will make the best of any scenario. They'll always be successful. They'll always find a way. They'll create something. So I think the question is always, have I got the right people? Are they in the right roles? And are they correctly incentivized and motivated?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got those things, you don't need to worry about, you know, a framework or the other things. You could do something like on a quarterly basis, but as long as those things are true, you then don't have to worry about it, which means it's less about the framework, it's more about the people. We need to have the hard conversations about who's in the business and how do we bring the right people in and maintain and motivate those people, which is why I think I also have a problem with OKRs, is that it means that people have got a framework to hide under, or like, or just be complicit in, yeah, you know, I'm just doing what is on this piece of paper. I haven't thought more holistically about the health of that thing and that department I'm responsible for.
Yeah, I love it. I'm curious of mindset, skill set, and structure. Which one do you think are the hardest of those three to get?
First one. Because if you don't have the first one, you can't get the second one.
Right. Look, I'm in agreement there. So that's the sort of like where it becomes magic stuff. Like, how do you get mindset? Is it like just you get lucky, you find someone that's born with it? Can you create mindset? Can you generate mindset? Or is it like you get the mindset you get and you work with the mindset you get?
It's really funny, isn't it? Shawshank is coming up a lot today. But I had this conversation with a friend and I was like, he's really senior. He owns his own business. He's done really well for himself. But he was like, it's really easy for Shawshank to have that mindset and process because he's got the body. And I was like, no. You've got that the wrong way around. Like, he was tall, but he's got that physique because he has the mindset. The mindset is what drives your success. It's the mindset that drives you acquiring those skills. It's the mindset that drives you to acquire anything that you need to be successful. And it struck me about 18 months ago is that I've been, for a lot of my career, I've been coaching skills and behaviors. This is what you do when someone says this. This is how you close a deal. This is the way you respond. This is how you price. This is objection handling. This is the way you write an email. But they're all secondary and they're really short. Like we can teach that thing and they'll do it maybe for a day or two. And then they'll fall back into old habits. And it's because the mindset drives behavior.
Yep.
It's the mindset that drives growth. So we do need to change mindset, but it's really hard. And that's over a period of time, but it requires a load of different inputs and it needs them to think differently about what they're doing and their impact on the business. So I don't think there's any one answer for like any business, but it's something that I struggle with in getting that mindset right in a lot of the businesses, because it also needs to be grounded in really good ethics as well.
Do you agree? Like,
it's not about you having a growth mindset just so that you can be successful and seen to be successful either.
Yeah. So obviously we're very aligned here. I agree. Mindset is the elusive sort of, you know, characteristic that we hope for. And the catch 22 is, you know, people that have the mindset that we know we want are usually already doing something. They don't need us, you know. They're hardest to people to capture because their mindset takes them in their own direction, you know.
So this is why you see successful sports people become successful business people, and yep, you know,
they bring success, that everywhere. Yeah,
they just bring that energy. Like, they bring that to every part of their life.
I think this is sort of like the weird, you know, conundrum we have too around mating. You know, it's like, why would somebody date me? Anybody that's qualified to date me is already dating. You know, they're already taken. You know. So, you know, the timing has to be right where you just meet someone at the right time when they happen to be available and you capture them and you get lucky, you know. But people with the right mindset, they can get anybody they want. They're sort of in this sort of state where they pick and choose their mates. And, you know, this is sort of like when someone is chasing you, you think, well, they must not have a very good mindset if they're chasing me, because someone who's chasing me would not be chasing anybody. I'm not that great, you know? So same thing when it comes to hiring people, right? So I'm analogizing here. We're trying to capture people with the right mindset.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, how do you get someone to come work for you unless you're promising them some way in which their mindset can be activated that meaning is meaningful to them, right? And I don't know, for people like that, money is enough. You know, some of it, they need to be a mission. They need to be involved in something that where their mindset is going to be activated in a way that's sustainable, because that's what the people like that want. And you got to find people like that. That's hard. I mean, I think this is the big issues that people have, is that you fill your company up with people whom take on positions for their own reasons, which are all valid and honorable reasons. I mean, I need to make money. I got to feed my kids. But, you know, and for some people, those incentives are enough because they're ambitious, because they want to make enough money to put their kids through school. And those are fine. Those are good. Those are motivations. But that doesn't necessarily match the mindset. So,
you can also achieve those in loads of different places.
Yes. Right. So then the key then is really figuring out some way, I guess, they're probably out there, is some way that you could have a diagnostic, like a blood test or an MRI that can be able to reveal someone's mindset, which maybe it's there. I don't know if it's there. I wouldn't say it's a physical thing, but there's probably some inquiry you can make where the responses indicate it. You know, I think that's probably there. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure it's there. And then the second thing is then identifying the mindset that then comes in a package of competency that is appropriate for the thing you need, right? So if I need someone who's an engineer, I need an engineer with the right mindset, or I need a salesperson with the right mindset, or I need a RevOps person with the right mindset. And this is like the biggest riddle, you know. This one is like, I don't know how people do it. I think that's the magic part, is all of a sudden comes together, you know, and it's like, oh my God, that was like, look at Led Zeppelin, right? I mean, I look at this a lot. He's like the four best players of their instrument, right? And they just kind of really randomly got together, and it was destined to be magical. I mean, I heard the first time they played, I read a lot, I'm kind of a Zeppelin freak, but they played for the first time together ever in a studio. They just sat down, they all looked at each other and were like, holy shit. Like, they just sort of knew, like, okay, we're pretty much four of the best people at everything, so how cool is this? And they were like, let's stay together for the next 10 years and just make magic. It doesn't happen enough. We all want that to happen, you know?
Agree. We should talk Zeppelin another time, because I'm a big fan, John Bonham.
I saw them live, by the way, in 1977.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. A lot older than you think. So, yeah, I went to see them when I was in the Madison Square Garden on the opening night there. So
that's great. Just growth mindset, I don't think it's hard to game, but it's easy to spot if you're in a room, because, like, so part of my role is, like, I'll go in and work with leadership teams. I haven't got that much control over the people in the room. So I have to uncover and help identify people with growth mindset, the people who are the ones that I think are going to be the allies in this growth journey, and focus on committing to that growth journey. But for recruitment, it's a bit easier for us to uncover those things. We can set tasks, give them really hard feedback, tell them bad news, see how they take it. Let's see if they have a follow-up question. I didn't think your close was very good, Warren. How is Warren going to respond? If he asks why or how I could do it better, that's a great precursor. Let's ask him what the last thing he learned was. What was the hardest journey he's done? What was the greatest lesson he took from one of his managers? All of those things are good pre-markers to growth mindset. But in your question about, I'll play your analogy back to you as well. Like, if we think about love, and if we think about bringing people on the journey with us, is the best... The best example of love I've ever heard, a definition, is that it's a shared view of the future. There's lots of people that I could have a relationship with who have, you know, maybe some of the same interests. Like, they might like Led Zeppelin the same as me, or, you know, they may be the same height or same religion. But true love is a shared vision of the future. And it's the same with business. When we want people to lend us their career, we need to give them our vision and see if it aligns with them. Because they're buying into us and lending us their career for that amount of time. And if we haven't got a really clear management mantra and the reasons we do our job and what we're good at, to your earlier analogy, Warren, is how is it that other people are going to know why they want to work with us and come on the journey with us? Because if I bring a salesperson on, I can tell them how to be a really good salesperson, and they can learn a load from me if that's what they want. If they want to earn lots of money, you know, maybe they can go somewhere else and do that. But if they see in me something they want to learn, they're going to come on the journey and earn some money as a byproduct as well. Back to the earlier thing as well, like, let's not focus on outcomes. Let's focus on inputs and our things that we can control, so that they get us to where we need to be.
Yeah, it's all pertinent. It's really valuable. I think these are things that you don't think about enough until you become the owner of a business, when all of a sudden these things become more pertinent to you. Right? I think we see them. I mean, I've worked in big companies and small companies, and we all can have like a perspective on it. Like, I'm in the marketing department, and I see the dynamics of this as it impacts my role and my ability to do my job. But I have a very much like a almost like a functional position on this. But all of a sudden I'm running the business, and I see it differently. Like, you know, this is always the case when, you know, you're running a business and you're doing things to people and they complain. it, you know that they lack the experience of knowing what it's like to run a system as opposed to run a function. And they just don't see it from a different perspective until all of a sudden they have it, you know? It's that sort of weird maturation phase when people lose their innocence from being someone that worked for somebody and someone that now is responsible for somebody. And I do think that these are the bigger questions that come into play all of a sudden. And, you know, the level of responsibility that you've taken on when you run a business, people don't understand the insurmountable size.
No. And I also think I did that bad thing of being a sales leader in that I was so focused on hitting the number that nothing else mattered. And which would either be boom or bust mindset of I'm smashing it. We're on it. Nothing can stop us. All of that stuff we've done has allowed us to get to where we are. I'm great. This is brilliant. To when you're not hitting the target, it's the worst thing ever. And you're so in it, you can't even take yourself out and think about all of the inputs. Is the target right? What is it that's not going right across the rest of the business? Is it just me? Is it a collection of things? You end up being like so deep into it, you just can't see the wood for the trees. It's it's just crazy. So I feel like, to your point, Warren, the best thing that's happened to me over the last 3 years is stepping sideways a bit to become a better leader and understanding that broader context is why stuff gets fucked up and why it falls over. Mm-hmm. Is because we're in too many silos.
Agreed. And this is the whole thing. Why I started my business was to break that down. And it wasn't just about building a new RevOps, function, which is needed. Right. That's to your point, I think it's a good one, like your framework. That's the structure part, right? Which people tend to look at structure. Structure is easy to look at, right? You move things around. It's like rearranging furniture. It's like the couch would look better there. And, you can move it around, and there's a lot of satisfaction in moving furniture around because you could visualize it. You could see it, and it feels like an accomplishment. But if the people in the room don't get along with each other, it doesn't matter how the furniture is aligned. It sort of doesn't matter.
Or how they use the room.
Exactly. How the room is being used, right?
Yeah.
So I do think that that's the whole bigger picture is leadership and organizational dynamics and people dynamics, which is what we're really talking about. And those are harder things for people to figure out. They're harder for people to solve. But I do believe, to go back to the very beginning of our conversation, I believe that this is why it is that these businesses continue to not work, because we don't solve these problems. We solve the other ones. We solve the problems that are more, I guess, satisfying to solve, or they're measured to solve, right? Make more money, get more customers, close more deals, move this faster, hire more people. Those are things I can check off a box and I can say, okay, I did my job and I'll get off my back, as opposed to think differently. Why are you doing this? Why did you do that? What was the thing that we were thinking about? What might have been a different outcome for you? How could you recalibrate the way you approach problems, that you can do things differently? Or what are you best at? Why are you not? Like, that's a hard world to live in, but it's in my opinion, for me, as you could tell, it's a little more exciting. But
it's 100%. It's the cause and effect. If we go back to the sciences analogy, is all effects. Like, these are all outcomes that we're solving for here. We haven't even turned the tap off, but we're mopping up some of the water that's come out.
Mm-hmm.
It's great, and sometimes we need to do that in short term. Maybe the floor's slippery. We need to not slip over on this bit. But the problem is the tap is on, which is a harder thing to do and harder thing to grasp, because it requires not just organizational change, but like mindset shift as well. And especially if there's people in some of those roles in the businesses we're working with, that's maybe not what they want. Like, they are comfortable in their own way of working and not being challenged, and that's cool. But in order for that business to get to the next level of growth in a way that doesn't burn a huge amount of capital, in a way that doesn't cause really difficult working scenarios, they're going to have to change. Like, either that person changes, or someone comes in above or beside them to make sure that the business delivers.
Yeah. Love this conversation. So I'd love to hear, if you don't mind, a bit about your company. What is it you guys do? What's the offering that you provide? What are the outcomes that you produce? Who are your customers?
Yeah. Thanks, Warren. So I founded Committed to Growth to help SaaS businesses realize their revenue potential. I work with founding teams at different levels. I work with individual contributors to help them block, depending on what those revenue blockers are. So the three main things my business offers is consulting. So I will do coaching, I will do mentoring for anyone in role. So maybe it's someone who's getting to a head of sales, maybe it's a head of sales that's struggling or a CRO that's struggling, just being that external lens to help them understand where they can do their role better, or, you know, identify the ways they can work with different teams better. I will go in and do that job as well. So I'll be a fractional chief revenue officer for different businesses and go in and do the job, carry the bag, set up stuff. Not there for obviously the long term. So recruit people in to replace me, move on, do the same at other businesses. And then the final one is a board advisor to some of these businesses who are on the same growth trajectory or want to unlock the similar levels of growth, but want some expertise in someone who's done it previously. So ICP is SaaS, North America, US-based businesses who want to grow from zero to 10 million.
Great. Well, look, probably you and I could keep going on here for three more hours. I love this conversation.
Yeah, no, and we should talk about AC/DC as well. I saw them this year. Oh,
amazing, right? Watch old AC/DC footage, live shows from like the late 70s, early 80s.
Like Bonfire, yeah.
Unbelievable, right? It just is.
Bon Scott era.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yes, that's another band that never sold out. They always did the same thing all the time. They were what they were. They did it great. And you knew what you were getting, and you couldn't get it any better. It's great, great stuff.
Incredible brand.
Yeah. Well, look, I thank you for this. I really love this conversation. And how do people get a hold of you? What's the right way that people can talk to you if they're interested in working with you?
Yeah, great. Hit me up on LinkedIn. Nick Buxton, founder of Committed to Growth. Come and find me, DM me, drop me a message. We'd love to talk anything revenue, anyone's got any challenges with, or just an external sounding board. Don't have to be, you know, on the meter. Just pick my brains. Would love to have a chat about anything. It's all good fun. I love this stuff. So please drop me a note.
All right. Well, Nick, thank you so much. I enjoyed this a lot. Time flew here. It was so great. So a great meeting you, and I know we'll be talking more. So cheers. Thanks for listening to the CRO Insights podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode.